The reason that I wanted to organize the panel is that for the past 2 years I've been an English teacher of 12th grade students at Alta High School. And it's been a very interesting experience for me to be back in high school and listen to the kids and the way they think and the way they talk and what is important to them. And as I've done that for the last couple of years, I've been mulling over in my mind my own adolescent experience and what happened as I became a young adult and kind of moved into the adult world, and have compared that to what I hear these kids saying, and have thought that perhaps there are some things that we can do in the church that might make that journey from adolescence into adulthood a little bit easier in terms of spiritual life. And so that's what we want to address today. My name is Cindy Daly, and I have a bachelor's from BYU in humanities and a master's from the University of Chicago in film theory. I thought of the most impractical thing I possibly could, and worked for several years, and then really wanted to teach, and so I went back and got my teaching certificate, and now I'm a teacher at Alta. The other people on the panel, let me just go down the program here. Tony LaPrey is a psychologist working here in Salt Lake. He graduated from Utah State in psychology and has a PhD in counseling and psychology, I think, from BYU. He's taught at both BYU and the University of Utah, and he's worked as a psychologist in the Head Start program and also for Robert Kennedy. He's presently in private practice here in Salt Lake, and he has 5 grown children, all of whom are either psychologists or teachers. The next panelist is Toby Pingree. Toby graduated from the University of Utah and got his MBA from Harvard, and went into financial planning. He's been a bishop 3 times, once in Ithaca, New York, and once in Albuquerque, New Mexico. He was a mission president in Ecuador from 1982 to 85, and when he came home from that assignment, they moved to Walnut Creek, California, where he works for a financial planning firm and has been the bishop of a singles ward there since 1986. And he has 6 kids, and his son says they've all been lots of trouble. Allie Jepson is a graduate, a 1993 graduate of Alta High School, and she plans to attend the University of Utah in the fall. She loves the outdoors and sports, and Allie ended up on this program because she happened to be one of my students. She took creative writing from me last year, and as a result of that, I got to know her a little bit through her writing and found her to be a very careful, thoughtful writer. And I always thought of Allie as I was preparing my lessons for my creative writing classes. I didn't want to disappoint her, and I think that I often did. But she, I think, helped raise the level of my teaching in that class. The other panelist who is in your final program, he wasn't in the preliminary program, is Preston Lear. Preston graduated from East High School and served a mission in West Virginia, and I think he returned rather recently. I don't know how long it's been. He's presently a student at the University of Utah in pre-med, and he loves rock climbing and skiing. We'll go ahead then, and we're going to have Allie and Preston speak first, and they're going to talk about their own personal experience and the way it is that they have experienced Mormonism, and tell us what I think that they're going to maybe tell us what's worked for them and what hasn't, and then I and Toby and Tony will follow, and I think the sequence will be me and then Tony and then Toby. So I'll turn the time over to Allie.
I'm Allie Jepson, and like she said, I graduated from Alta. Being raised in the LDS Church, I grew up with particular beliefs and values, unique in comparison to many other religions. A strict religious home was beneficial to me in many ways. There's always order and structure, defined values, a sense of belonging, and answers to the questions of why am I here, where am I from, and what am I doing. I always knew that every Sunday my family would go to church, come home, have family home evening, and scripture study. I knew how to act and what was expected of me by my parents and by other adult leaders. I was supposed to go to church, participate in mutual activities, and earn my young women medallion. There was quite a bit of security in knowing, you know, what would happen around my home and my community. It provided a sense of consistency in a time of when you're feeling emotionally chaotic growing up. I also learned a lot from the value system put out for the youth: morality, drugs, alcohol, dress code, high standard of judgment for the media. For every situation, there was a do and a don't. And for a situation that was maybe questionable or risque, there was always a right way out. But as I got older, I began to question whether these values and this doctrine was what I really believed. Choice and accountability is a concept upon which the church is based, but the outline standards are so strict that disobeying would mean disfellowship or excommunication. And because of this fear, the sole motivator to obeying the rules was that. It was only after I released this fear of being rejected and shamed by an important force that I'd grown up with, by all the people I loved and cared about, and having the threat of losing the Holy Ghost, did I really begin to spiritually progress. I was really just learning that I must find out for myself answers to my spiritual quest. But to question what respected authoritarian figures had always taught me was really unheard of, and I just felt like the doctrine and principles were a set of restrictive rules. And if I were going to follow them, I wanted a good reason to. For example, the Word of Wisdom says not to drink coffee, tea, alcohol, and to refrain from using drugs and other harmful substances. And the reward for this would be unfaltering strength in every area of your life. I was curious about what it would be like to experience these things, but I was afraid of the consequences that the church would put on me, not my body and not God. So fear rather than a love for the doctrine or belief in the doctrine dictated my behavior. Also, according to LDS doctrine, one is to refrain from adultery, premarital sex, petting, necking, and kissing of a passionate nature. I never really got an explanation of why I shouldn't engage in these kind of activities. It's just kind of like slap on the hand type of no. And perhaps if the church emphasized more about the risk of pregnancy, sexually transmitted diseases, the risk of emotional immaturity and involvement, the tragedy of being used or a ruined marriage, and the possibility of acquiring an unhealthy sense of self-esteem from doing these things would have helped me to better stand that these rules were there to prevent pain rather than create it. Also, women's equality in the Mormon church became a very big issue for me. I wanted to know why women could and did not hold the priesthood just like the men did. I wanted to know why women were encouraged to stay home before a career, while for men it wasn't even an issue. I would ask teachers and leaders why women did not hold the priesthood, and I got answers like, it's not the time, or men are just naturally less spiritual than women, so they need this, or that's just the traditional place of men and women. And that just really upset me because it didn't really make it okay for me. And the thing that kept popping into my head was when the church decided to give black men the right of the priesthood, and they said it was a vision that made them decide this, but there was a march planned for the next day, and there was many people petitioning for black men to get the priesthood, and that sort of makes me think it was the people's action rather than a vision that caused them to get the priesthood. And the best way for a child to develop skills for dealing with life, you know, experience a satisfying spiritual life, is to experience disappointment, miscalculation, and uncertainty. While most parents want their child to be spared pain and sadness, is an absolute necessary occurrence for a child's spiritual growth. It is in times of fear, pain, and difficulty that one turns to the spiritual side of life. For many teenagers, spirituality, God, and religion are not really important issues until something happens that will force he or she to question it. In a sense, it is better for the child to hit rock bottom rather than be spared the pain and consequences of their actions. For a parent, that can be one of the most very difficult things to do. For example, if a parent hears that their child has been involved with drugs or alcohol or any other situation that they don't approve of, the most effective thing the parent can do is to yell, threaten, or bribe the child. Communication is the most important tool to use. If the child is involved in a situation that the parent does not approve of, the child will already know that before the parent even finds out. Talk of the child as an equal, share feelings on the subject, and allow honesty, and try to see both sides of the story. Even if the child is clearly making a mistake, allow them to. If the child wants to do something he or she knows the adult won't approve of, lying and manipulation will always take its course. Let go of the situation, trust that God and or the process of life knows what's going on better than you. Love and support the child, don't shame them, and don't play private investigator. Try to sincerely trust the child, and they will, from that, trust you. And from this, not only is a child better to allowed to grow spiritually, but mentally and emotionally. And that's all.
Great to be here. Let me see if I'm trying to see who's here. Okay. I'm wondering if I can say certain things or not. Okay. I'm Preston Lear, and it's a pleasure to be here. And I'm going to be touching on a few of the same things that Allie touched on and also some others. As I think back on my experience as a missionary, I distinctly remember teaching a specific principle in the discussions. It had to do with the first mission of the church, which is to perfect the saints. At times I would cynically chuckle to myself when I'd contemplate whether the church had really accomplished its mission in perfecting me as a youth of Zion. Had the programs in the church really helped me strengthen my spiritual self? Had the seminary courses, the Sunday school lessons, priesthood quorum meetings, father's interviews been effective in training me up in the way I should go? As I weigh the good and the not so good, it is in these programs, I would have to say that in spite of some weaknesses and inconsistencies, these programs did help me grow closer to the Savior. The wonderful aspect of the restored gospel is that the principles are taught, even in the Sunbeam classes, stem from a gospel that understands the eternal application of the commandments. In other words, being taught certain rules and commandments in conjunction with the concepts of free agency and the atonement, puts these rules into a different light. The student learns that embracing these rules is a vehicle to lasting happiness. When I had teachers address such subjects as chastity, and they were discussed in an open and irrational manner, the principles seemed to hit home. Being taught that, quote, you're to do this because it is right, you're not to do this because it is wrong, had very little positive impact on me. There were times when, like so many kids in this valley, I was a reactionary rebel without a clue. Anything that was even remotely linked to an organization turned me off, including the church. I suppose that growing up in Utah had some influence on my attitude, and also there were factors within my family that fanned the flames in this situation. However, during times of frustration, when I was about to throw my gospel upbringing out with the bathwater, understanding and empathetic instructors were my boon. These were teachers that taught us all on an individual level. I remember one such teacher whose lessons began with, what do you want to talk about this week? These weren't lessons out of the manual. There were no subjects that were taboo, no subjects that were glossed over. The feeling was unassuming, and the spirit was there. I don't know how many times I heard the adage, oh, Preston, the gospel is perfect, but the people are not. Well, sooner or later, this is a discovery to all who are or can be called saints. It's a theory that has kept me going, even though at times it's a frustrating challenge to keep plodding along. I've learned that during times like these, I must get back to the basics that were taught to me, which are study and prayer. I was taught, as it says in the Doctrine and Covenants, to search, pray, and feel. This is a foundation that, if heeded, has helped me weather the storm. Spiritual well-being is a personal thing. I love the opportunity to grow at my own pace and to develop my testimony through these exercises. Ezra Taft Benson professes the value of daily reading out of the Book of Mormon. Now, I don't do this every day, but when I have, it's given me a lot of strength. No matter how dry some of the conference talks sound, how inept some lesson manuals may be, which is pretty extensive at times, and how rotten the fruit of some eccentric members of the church is, personal study and prayer cannot lead one astray. They are the major influences in my conversion. Since I mentioned something about spoiled fruit, I may as well be objective about this topic and mention some things that I feel that could change for the better. One thing that was often missing, as Allie was mentioning, was open-minded, objective discussion about certain gospel subjects. It seemed that many of the lessons laid a foundation of basic truths, which is good, but oftentimes the teachers were wary to bring up anything that was not printed in black and white on the manual. For students to ask questions that seemed to go off on a tangent were often implied as borderline heresy. Certain areas, due to a lack of discussing them, also seemed taboo. Subjects such as polygamy, blacks receiving the priesthood, and even the issue of women having not received the priesthood. I was ill-prepared to discuss these areas comfortably in the mission field, yet I was asked them on a daily basis. And we're talking West Virginia. They didn't read the paper. A lot of people didn't read the paper in these smaller towns and weren't aware of what Mormons believe. All they knew was Mormons and polygamy. Aren't you guys the ones who, you know, marry eight wives? And I was never taught really an answer that was satisfactory to me or a answer that was satisfactory to them until I researched it on my own. When members have a testimony in the gospel, they should not be afraid to discuss issues that may not seem aesthetically pleasing. The lessons need to be geared to give students the benefit of the doubt as they search for their own individual understanding of the gospel. Sweeping certain issues under the rug sends mixed messages. Choose the right, things are always black and white, was a member teaching that was in a lot of my lessons growing up. This was very frustrating to me. Kids are smart, and they're perceptive. The gospel needs to be taught on a more mature level and an open level to youth at a younger age. The whys should accompany the do's and the don'ts. And if there is not a concrete answer to a particular why, this needs to be acknowledged, not avoided. My greatest teachers never professed to have all of the answers. This made me feel more comfortable. To switch gears, I'll ask the question, is there any implied sexism in the youth activities of the church? As a young man, I was able to go out on outings with the scouts in my priesthood quorum that were not only a blast, but they were very beneficial to my spiritual growth. My scout leaders were wonderful role models to me. Being in the outdoors created a comfortable setting for all of us to discuss spiritual subjects without seeming too geeky. Unfortunately, I don't see the young women of the church receiving their fair share of activities. Yes, they have a little medallion achievement award, and they have Brighton summer camp, but a trip up Big Cottonwood is a far cry compared to a trip to Canyonlands. I also don't see a plaque with individual girls' names on it who've achieved this certain award sitting next to the Eagle Scout plaque in the church foyer. A PhD in psychology isn't necessary for Mormons to sense that there's a need for a change. On a similar note, the opportunity that I had to serve a mission was an experience that dramatically heightened my spiritual awareness. I wonder why young women are not encouraged to serve full-time missions as young men are. It's more of, well, if you want to, you know, if you kind of feel like it, and, well, you know, you have nothing else going. There may be a reason. There may be a reason for this that I'm not qualified to understand, but I still often wonder. One other thing that I didn't write down, but it just came to mind as I was sitting, was I think it's a different situation here in Utah, or where there's a number of members of the church that have been raised in the church, than it is, say, in the mission field, West Virginia, for instance. the lesson manuals and the programs that are provided by the church and encouraged by the church. For instance, family home evening, the manuals, little pamphlets that parents are encouraged to share with their children. Those are good for people who don't have a grasp of the gospel. And they can be good for people who do. However, I think there's an adverse effect of these little pamphlets and these things. They can tend to be overused and relied upon as opposed to discretion of the Spirit in teaching children on an individual level. This is an example of a family setting. For instance, using a pamphlet to teach sexual education, in my opinion, can be inept and seem cold and not quite there. And yet, you know, for some people that can be very effective if they really don't know how to discuss it. I just think that more emphasis needs to be put on the church, given to the members, to use discretion of the Spirit as parents, use discretion of the Spirit as teachers. I love this gospel. I'm grateful for my parents and the teachers that show me love. I believe that the most spiritually attuned people in the church need to be the ones working with the youth of the church. It's these individuals that actually make it or break it when it comes to helping us develop our spiritual side.
I just have something to add to what Preston said about the implied sexism. As I was working on this talk, I went through the personal progress book for girls, and they get to do things like make dinner and do family history and write in their journal, and the boys get to do life-saving and knot tying, and I think that either the boys should have to do personal progress or the girls should get to do what the boys get to do. This last year, I taught the novel Ordinary People to my 12th grade English classes. During a conversation in the book, the character Ray reveals his existential philosophy of life. People are born, he says, then they die. In between, they perform a lot of pathetic and more or less meaningless actions. As a writing assignment, I asked my students to agree or disagree with Ray's view of life and then tell me what their philosophy of life was and what they might expect from life based on that philosophy. I was a bit surprised to receive numerous testimonies from my Mormon students. I'd like to read an excerpt from a paper that I received. My philosophy is pretty simple. I have always been taught that there is purpose for us to be on earth. Our religion believes that the purpose in life is to get married in the temple and get sealed to our families. The reason this is important is because we as families will be together forever. I'm thankful for my religion because I don't think life would be right without it. When I'm at church and I'm at my classes and I'm learning about our church, it comes more into perspective for me. I don't have all the answers, and I never will, but all I know is that I get the best feeling when I'm at church and doing the right thing. I have never put down anyone's religion. I have a friend that is Catholic, and lately I feel like we have fallen away from each other. I'm not saying people that aren't LDS are bad, but they don't have what we have. Other religions can go do anything else, like drink or smoke, and then go to church on Sundays. That is not right. The one thing that I think other people are missing is having your family with you forever. People that don't have my religion believe when you die, it is over, but that is where people are wrong. When we die, we will be up in heaven with our families, teaching other people about our religion, giving other people a chance to join our church. We can't make people believe what we believe. All we can do is share our testimonies with them, and I hope one day they will feel the same wonderful feeling that we do. This student's writing suggests several things. The first is that she is learning about her religion and spiritual life in concrete, right, wrong, narrowly defined terms. At least that's what she seems to be internalizing. The potential I perceive in this kind of understanding is a stunted spiritual experience because leaders and parents encourage talk about specific religious ritual and specific social behaviors as the ultimate end in defining spiritual fulfillment. We talk a lot about what members should do rather than looking ardently at why we should do it. We also cite simple examples and define clear parameters when we teach moral and religious principles, steering clear of fuzzy borders and cloudy answers. As a teacher, I find this phenomenon interesting because it goes against what pedagogical research says adolescents are capable of understanding. Preston says kids are smart, and I agree, they are smart. Lawrence Steinberg, in his book Adolescence, looks at five domains that show the difference in thinking between a child and an adolescent. I'd like to look at three of those: role-taking, moral reasoning, and social conventions, suggesting ways we might help adolescents gain deeper spiritual understanding given their developed thought processes. According to the research Steinberg cites, in the area of role-taking, older children are able to put themselves in another's shoes, but they have difficulty seeing how one person's perspective affects another's. Adolescents are able to take a third party or mutual perspective and to see the bigger societal picture. When it comes to moral reasoning for children, morals are based on concrete rules handed down by authorities. For adolescents, morals come out of agreements between people or out of abstract principles. Lastly, for children, social conventions are based on the rules and dictates of authorities. Adolescents see that conventions are based on expectations or grow out of social norms. Steinberg concludes saying these shifts are necessary if the adolescent is to generate an implicit theory of personality that enables him or her to judge the behavior of others, to understand and coordinate the perspectives and points of view of others, and to seek social conventions and moral guidelines as emanating from individual shared understanding rather than as the mindless dictates of authority. What I see in my students' writing are statements that sound much more like a child's than an adolescent's. Even though she is chronologically, socially, and cognitively capable of thinking through the more interesting and consequently the more complex questions of existence, she seems to be relying on childlike explanations. The meaning of life? To get married in the temple and get sealed to our families. How can one be happy? All I know is that I get the best feeling when I'm at church and doing the right thing. The difference between this student and a person with a different theology, they can go do anything else like drink or smoke and then go to church on Sundays. The purpose of an eternal existence? To teach other people about our religion. If these answers just sounded simplistic, I would shrug off the naivete, recognizing that this student has a philosophy that is spiritually satisfying to her. But my worry, and certainly my own life experience bears this out, is that as one moves out of adolescence, these concrete answers don't get at the heart of life's meaning, and depending on immature explanations to life's most important questions, creates spiritual disillusionment. How does a person who perceives her religious life as dependent on the things my student writes about deal with a life that never includes temple marriage, or a life that includes chronic depression? Or religious theologies that seem to address important spiritual needs in a more satisfying way than her own? Or relationships that make the belief that the afterlife boils down to teaching other people our religion seem woefully inadequate? I think a rich spiritual life requires religious thinking that goes beyond concrete, right, wrong, list-generated thinking. How can adolescents develop their spiritual thinking so that when they face situations like the ones I've cited, they see them as experiences to be worked through, endured, reconciled, or embraced as an inherent part of their spiritual life, rather than feeling disillusioned, depressed, helpless, or betrayed? I think at least a bit of the answer may go back to the domain Steinberg talked about. Remember that by late adolescence, a teenager can understand that the perspectives people have on each other are complicated, often unconscious, and influenced by larger forces than individuals can control, including each person's position in society or within a social institution. Recognizing this, teachers and parents should be willing to explore with kids the possibility that even having made the best decision one can make using the Oliver Cowdery formula, a person's conclusion is still tied to an infinite number of other decisions or people or roles. It may not be, in other words, so simple as studying it out in one's mind, praying, and receiving an answer. That the answer is subject to other forces doesn't negate its veracity, but the human condition and one person's place in it is often more complicated than the examples that are used to illustrate specific principles. In the domain of moral reasoning, again, children tend to see morals as concrete rules handed down by authorities. Adolescents are able to see that morals are agreements made between people or grow out of a system of abstract principles. This difference seems imperative to me. In a lesson in the Laurel Manual on decision-making, a note in the book after several case studies says, "Do not allow the discussion to focus on the decision the girl made in each situation. Focus on the process rather than the decision." I think this is great instruction. It seems to me, though, that usually we are much too willing to present the correct moral choices to adolescents and simply tell them to choose the right answer, and then we call it free agency. And I think you heard both Allie and Preston talk about the frustration that they felt at this. We quote a church leader who articulates the correct choice and then tell adolescents they should do what the leaders tell them to do. Examining moral implications, looking at messy dilemmas, considering relative degrees of morality are sidestepped. Focusing on the struggle helps illuminate moral relationships and pays respect to the individual who works through the problem. Even if the outcome remains a bit muddy, the adolescent at least begins to grasp a principle that over time shows consistency and can be applied to situations. Perhaps we should encourage adolescents to construct an imperfect, broad moral framework rather than a perfect framework that won't encompass some individual spiritual burdens. The last domain I want to touch on is the domain of social convention. Again, children understand social convention as rules or dictates of authorities, while adolescents are able to understand that social conventions are expectations that grow out of social norms or traditions. The distinctions between religion, spirituality, morality, and social convention are often blurry, and we perpetuate the haziness rather than trying to distinguish the differences. In order to encourage teenagers to follow certain behaviors or refrain from others, I think we are guilty of correlating socially normative behavior with sin. In Paul's day, women needed to cover their heads and were not supposed to speak in church. Today we see that as a social convention, but I suspect girls in Paul's time were conditioned to believe that those customs were morally correct. When we are talking about morality, which Lowell Bunyan defines as what it means to be a good man or a good woman, what behavior is pleasing to God and how people should treat each other, we often place inappropriate emphasis on particular behaviors while other moral behavior of the same or greater magnitude is slighted. The student whose paper I read equates drinking and smoking with morality and then mentions it as the predominant behavior that defines a person's religious honesty. We need to help adolescents begin to distinguish between morality and social convention. If we don't, young people who find that certain social conventions are suffocating, unsatisfying, or silly are faced with an uncomfortable dilemma. Because they have been trained to accept a convention as being right, they see themselves as misusing their free agency, choosing wrongly, when in fact there is no particular right-wrong imperative. There may be the weight of history, there may be practicality, or the majority adhering to the convention may make life easier on the collective society, but a choice rejecting convention isn't necessarily immoral. Adolescents still must reconcile their struggle and spiritual framework to their religious community's values, theology, and moral framework. They are capable of and must be willing to work out how their individual role fits into a larger societal picture, how and why moral decisions stem from agreements that people make between one another, what their responsibility is to that moral relationship, and how and why societal norms are an important part of individual and institutional histories. I don't think recognizing struggle and accepting incomplete answers leaves adolescents bereft of support and spiritual satisfaction. I think it encourages free agency, but it switches the emphasis from a correct, predetermined outcome to a valuing of individual autonomy and search for self, while providing community from which the adolescent can launch herself or ground himself. Recognizing conflicting principles and acknowledging individual departures needn't be upsetting and scary for teenagers. In fact, as adolescents begin to put away childish things, I think they yearn for a more complex system that will give them the thinking tools, principles, and possibilities to face an infinite set of circumstances and challenges that fall within the framework of the human condition. As adults, we owe it to adolescents to give them more than a finite set of choices with clear-cut answers.
As a psychologist working in Salt Lake City, working mostly with Mormon families and adolescents, I have come to develop a definition of a Mormon male adolescent is 137 pounds of pure testosterone in Reeboks. I think that it's interesting. One of the things that I often see, somebody will bring a child into me, and you'll have Father Bishop come in with Molly Mom and Robert Rebel, who's 16 years old, and they will say, Robert Rebel does not want to attend family home evening anymore. Do your magic psychology thing and make him do family home evening. And I think that often Mormon parents forget that the first principle of the gospel was free agency, and they think that that obedience is the most powerful thing that there is, and that our teenagers love to rebel, and they want to have something to rebel against. Mormon teenagers are some of the greatest rebels in the world, and they have all of the system in place so that they can rebel. They can rebel against by alcohol, tobacco, drugs, sexuality, and it's just wonderful because that's the best way that they can rebel, and they can get to their parents in that way, and they do it wonderfully. And the parents, if we don't understand the principle of free agency and allow children the opportunity of trying out things, exploring the world, and understanding what's going to happen to them, and let them take a look at some consequential behavior themselves, and get an understanding of these things, then what we're doing is we're really raising up a generation of rebels or clones, and either one of those to me is unacceptable. We have in our society at the present time vast changes are taking place. 67% of all first marriages end in divorce. Two out of three marriages end in divorce. 53% of temple marriages end in divorce. In those families with this type of situation, with the divorces going on, there are children. And these children are seeing what's happening, and they're reacting to those divorces, to the stress in the home, and to what may be happening. Now, divorce is a hereditary situation. If someone's parents are divorced, then the chances of a divorce occurring in the next generation are much higher than they would have been if they weren't. So divorce becomes a very critical faction for divorces continuing on. Adolescents see that divorce is a way to solve a problem. Get out of the situation. Don't stay and work on it, but get out of it. But with these kinds of statistics, 67% of Americans getting divorced in their first marriages, 53% of temple marriages getting divorced, the number of marriages in second marriages is about 85%. So you can see the divorce rate is very high. And what does that do to the children, particularly to the adolescents, as they grow up? Most of these kids are going to reside in a single family parent situation for at least 4 to 5 years. The average is 4 to 5 years. And so what happens during that time? The parents are under great stress. Usually there's a custody battle. Lawyers are getting rich from that. And so we see that this causes extreme stress in the kids. And these stresses are manifest in the teenagers that we see today. And all we have to do is pick up the newspaper and we can see some of these stresses that are being felt in adolescence. Delinquency is very common. The gangs are extremely common. The gang movement in America has grown out of situations, for the most part, of children who have no fathers. The fathers have left and they're no longer there to provide those kids with their mentor relationship, and the kids react to that. They need something to bond to. If they can't bond to the church, if they don't have their free agency so that they can bond with a church, they're going to bond with a peer group. And those peer groups could be the gangs or whatever other peer group that they can fit into. Depression is extremely common in adolescents. And dealing with those depressions in family dysfunction or in family disillusion can be devastating for these kids. The suicide rate for teenagers is incredibly high, and it's getting higher every day. And some of the reasons for this, I think, are the disillusion of the family. Drugs and alcohol, of course, are running extremely high, and the children within the church are not immune to this. It's drugs and alcohol are very much available. And sexual acting out has become almost a norm rather than something that would be different. Because of the teenager's ability to rebel so wonderfully, sometimes the teenagers are acting out in aberrant ways. And we see a movement within the gay community with homosexuals and lesbians where teenagers will try that for a while as a bit of rebellion because the parents often are so rigid in the way that they present things that the kids need a way of acting out. One of the things that I see very often is poor sibling relationship. These kids develop just horrible relationships with their brothers and sisters. And the parents then take away their free agency and say, you will obey and you will do this my way. And the thing that they don't recognize that a sibling relationship is probably the best relationship that children have to try out a marital relationship. Your relationship with your brother or your sister is going to be exactly the same way that you're going, exactly the same relationship as you have when you grow up and get married and have a relationship with your husband and wife. And it's that period of time is a time for practicing. And parents don't allow children the opportunity of practicing that relationship and working out their own problems. Often the father will put on his striped shirt and take his whistle, and he will then become the referee and blow the whistle, and the mother or the father will put on the judge's robes and set it at the dinner table and hand down sentences. I can see that's happened to some of you already. Rather than letting the children work out their problems, because this can be one of the most wonderful problem-solving situations that can have. Because divorce is cumulative, and it occurs more in this generation than it occurs in the next generation, with 67% of families in the United States dissolving now, it's going to increase in the next generation. As members of the church, if we take a look at that, we take a look at what we need to do within the church, within our own families, to provide our kids with relationships that will help them have stronger families, stronger ties to their community, stronger ties to their church, stronger ties to their siblings. These are some of the things that we may need to take a look at. One of the things I think that was mentioned both by Ali and Preston is the mentor relationships. And I think this is de-emphasized a lot in the church, particularly with the girls. The mentor relationships are stressed with the scoutmasters, with the boys, but with the girls this is not stressed. And often I think that these girls need a mentor relationship, not particularly with a female, but with a male, because they have a father who is absent from the home. And it seems that we need to have some vehicle where we can provide some of those mentor relationships within the church, and we're not able to do that. The difference between the mentoring of boys and girls and the activities, as Preston pointed out, within the church is very great, and I think that that's causing a great deal of either two things: rebellion in the women in the church, or molliness in the women in the church. And either one of those things, in my book, is unacceptable. What we need to do with our kids is teach them to think. We teach our children to think by giving them experiences, to have them live in an experiential world where they can gain rewards from thinking and making decisions, or they can obtain consequences from thinking and making decisions. Free agency should be something that would strengthen families throughout all of these kinds of things. And these are some of the kinds of things that I see with adolescents in the church and some of the solutions. Thank you.
When Cindy approached me about participating in this panel concerned with the spiritual development of LDS adolescents, she indicated that she believed that my experience serving three times as a bishop and being a father of six very individualistic children qualified me to make a contribution. Regarding the bishoping part of it, I protested somewhat since it's been almost 20 years since I was a bishop of a ward that had teenagers. But she pointed out that being a bishop of a single adult ward, young single adult ward, has you dealing with the consequences of those programs, and so that that might give me some experience to talk about, and so I'm here to share my experience with you. I want to first look at where I think church programs have been successful in helping men and women prepare for the challenges of life. Church programs have done a great deal to help guide teenagers during those stressful years, as we've heard mentioned earlier. Young church members have been provided a code to live by, which includes explicit and implicit rules for personal conduct and discipline. This provides direction in life and facilitates personal decision-making process at certain levels. The church programs for youth provide positive, wholesome experiences that offer alternatives to destructive lifestyles, which can involve drugs, violence, sex, and crime as activities. These programs set forth a very specific code for living that, if followed, will avoid sexually transmitted diseases, enslaving substances, relationships which don't create nurturing environments for the next generation. They have opportunities for positive relationships built upon service to others and not abusing others. Youth conferences, welfare service projects, Saturday night dances, as well as the leadership and activity opportunities of weekly church service, or activities which I observe are generally positive in their impact. I've also seen positive results come from church teaching and learning program, which encompass Sunday class settings, as well as those which occur in seminary institutes. I've watched young people struggle with their doubts, gain scriptural insights, and learn to express their feelings while learning and studying with dedicated and sensitive teachers and instructors. In my experience, most, if not almost all, young people growing up under the influence of church programs have many positive experiences during that time. For most, the experience is the beginning of a lifetime growth and for self-improvement and growing confidence. Now let me focus for a few minutes on aspects of church programs which have not been helpful in the spiritual maturation of young Mormons. Ironically, the strengths of the programs which assist in many ways to help young people grow and develop can also be obstacles in their developing individual maturity and strength. There are some I have known, having grown up depending on church program and experiences to answer all of life's problems, find themselves unable to cope with the circumstances which don't fit into the regular pattern. They don't develop independent capacity to think for themselves and make moral choices outside of the structure under which they've grown up. When confronted with unfamiliar territory that includes new circumstances and challenges, they look to the old roadmap or programs and encounter answers which don't apply to new conditions. I think of the missionaries following the challenge to baptize who accept those who might be too young to know what they're doing. There's the married couple remembering counsel to not limit the size of their family who have added children even though the emotional or physical damage to the mother will almost certainly occur. A corollary to the concept that following church programs and produces answers to life challenges is the idea that there will be measurable and predictable rewards for righteous behavior. Keeping the commandments is supposed to assure positive results in an outpouring of the blessings from heaven. When the anticipated blessings don't flow from righteous and proper living, those who are disappointed have various reactions, including anger, feelings of betrayal, rejection of authority, and depression. I remember one young woman who questioned the value of sexual chastity after she observed an acquaintance, a daughter of an LDS church official, who seemed to have broken most of the rules of sexual restriction, yet ended up marrying a great guy in the temple and living happily thereafter, up to that point anyway. I have known young athletes who reported that teammates or opponents could get away with getting drunk or stoned with regularity and still beat out the clean living ones for starting spots on the team or all-star status. I recollect my own experience with a cigarette-smoking, beer-drinking junior high school bully who had me scared to death. One day I crossed him and he appeared bent on inflicting his form of just punishment upon me. Never being one noted for value, I started to run to avoid getting the tar kicked out of me. The thought kept coming to me that I could run and not be weary. While he would surely become faint and drop due to his sinful excesses. It didn't work out that way, as he kept right on my tail for what seemed to be an eternity. Many find that their lives, when they enter the workaday world, are not rewarded for right living. They see that those who mislead and lie, who take what doesn't belong to them, who are willing to sleep around, or who will let their conduct be governed by expectations of the group, are the ones most successful in business or the professions, while the righteous go on struggling at the bottom of the heap, finding it hard to get ahead. Church programs don't do a particularly good job in preparing one to live with these complex situations which don't turn out like they should. When righteous church members are passed over for promotion, when business activities of good Mormon entrepreneurs turn out badly, when faithful servants of the Lord fail to gain entrance to the best graduate schools, it can be a test of faith to those who have been led to believe that righteous living will be rewarded. In relationships between the sexes, it has been particularly disheartening to counsel numerous young adults, particularly women, who believe that they have been promised that marriage to a good man is theirs due to the personal righteousness they have practiced in their growing up years. When it doesn't come about according to the timetable they've expected, or doesn't happen at all, they wonder if there's something wrong with them or if they've been duped or lied to. They become angry at the old mutual teacher or at the Lord because they feel promises made have not been fulfilled. They may feel they're being punished for any number of sins, imagined or real, and their self-esteem can take a serious beating. I note there's wide misunderstanding of the scripture found in the 130th section of the Doctrine of Covenants, which states that there is a law irrevocably decreed in the heavens before the foundation of the earth upon which all blessings are predicated. And when we receive a blessing from God, it is because of obedience to that law upon which the blessing is predicated. Many conclude that obeying a law guarantees a desired outcome. Not so. The scripture only states that blessings are predicated on obedience to laws, not that there is an assured outcome of such obedience. The development field is another area where church programs and practices create difficulties for young people growing up in the church. Certainly guilt has many healthy attributes when it helps to serve as an indicator where change and repentance are needed. However, many come through church programs sensing that all they ever heard was emphasis on the evils of sin, the need to avoid improper activity and behavior, the importance of keeping the rules or else. Not going to church is bad. Using drugs will destroy your body. Violating the law of chastity will keep you from going on a mission or having a happy temple marriage. The negative message is what stuck with them. Since they weren't perfect individuals, they knew they were sinful and couldn't come to positive feelings about themselves. Church messages and sacrament and other meetings came across as calls to repent and challenges to abandon sin, constant reminders of inadequacies in a fallen state. The negative message sticks with them, and there is little recollection of any positive ideas as reasons for right living. They find themselves immersed in battles with a bad self-image and can't get around to feeling good about themselves. They interpret the events which don't turn out right as confirmation of their low self-worth, and they have a hard time developing successful, permanent, healthy relationships. Now, having pointed out some of the shortcomings in these church programs, what would I suggest as ways to help young people mature in church programs to be better prepared to deal with the realities of life? Specifically, I'll suggest, I think, four areas where we might consider some things. First of all, We need to communicate and confirm the idea that there are few, if any, guarantees in life when we try to predict the outcome of our living experiences. There are risks inherent in all aspects of living, and some of the best laid plans don't work out. Among those who follow the best health practices, there will be some who get sick and experience untimely death. Holding family home evening every Monday night does not guarantee that all children will turn out right, that there will be no empty chairs at the table. Avoiding physical petting and other sexual activities does not assure a marriage opportunity with a temple-qualified partner. The best that can be predicted as outcome of righteous living is simply an increase in the likelihood that things will go well, that they will turn out as we hope and pray. Second suggestion. Extend church callings to serve as for leaders who should go to those who have experienced so-called failure in their lives and learn from it. Search out those for whom life has not turned out as well as all would hope it would turn out and are still committed to the Savior and to His church. Have women in their 30s and 40s who have never married and are successful in life serve in the young women's program. Let divorced persons who have found life to be positive after a marriage breakdown serve in visible relief society and priesthood quorum positions. Third, encourage teachers to be honest about their personal doubts and struggles as well as their testimonies and faith-promoting experiences. Let young people know that it is legitimate and acceptable not to understand and believe everything. As these young people move into their later teen years, give them the opportunity to struggle with scenarios or case studies where the moral issues are complicated and resolutions not obvious. When is it more important to follow the dictates of one's conscience rather than to be obedient to rules and laws? Use real situations like Huebner in Germany in the 1930s, trying to decide whether to support the legitimate government or follow one's conscience to take precedence. Or like a new member of the church planning a wedding and trying to decide if a temple ceremony should have priority over honoring the wishes of parents who want to participate and can't be there. And then finally, stress the concept that the message of the gospel of Jesus Christ is positive and hopeful, not negative and depressing. People can put their sins behind them and be forgiven. Sexual relationships are not evil and destructive, but intended to be uplifting and bonding. Bad timing creates the problems. The love of Christ transcends many different lifestyles, and all are loved and accepted by Him. Thank you.
I did a bad thing. I didn't make people sit up here, and now I regret it because we have question and answers and they need to come up. So I'm wondering if you'll bring a chair and come sit here so we can do some question and answers. We have as long as we'd like to take, until 12:45. We don't have to go that long, but we can if we want, with questions and answers. If you have a question, if you'll just raise your hands and ask the question, I'll repeat it into the microphone. The session is being recorded, and then whoever needs to answer the question can do that. Yes. Go ahead. Okay, let me just repeat the question. The question is, if an adolescent particularly is from a divorced home and in one home he or she is learning one set of values or decision-making techniques and in the other household learning something just opposite, how does the adolescent go about sorting that out? Tony?
As parents, sometimes I think that we feel that the testosterone or the estrogen blocks the thought process in kids. But as I think that both Preston and Allie have said, these kids can think. And we need to let kids make their own choices. Help them so that they can use their free agency and use it appropriate. And you lay out the situations, and I think when you can have a black and white situation in a divorced family, what you do is you allow the kids to make some choices. Allow them to make those choices in a way that will give them the freedom to grow. I just had a thought. One of the things I often see in a divorce situation is one parent will be very lenient and one parent will be very rigid. And if that's the case in an adolescent situation, the kids then will gravitate towards the lenient parent. And that causes great consternation to to those who want everything black and white. And if the parent doesn't loosen up a little bit, then the kids will not only lose their kid in the gospel, but they'll lose their child in the family.
So are you asking what kind of people get called to leadership positions now? Okay. So he's saying that his perception is when he hears leaders in the church talk about the sins they've committed, they seem relatively insignificant compared to the rest of us. And he's wondering who actually does get called to these positions.
And have been successful at it, coping with it. They're going to be more influential in helping us as members than those who may be out on appear anyway to be on some outside level where they may not understand or relate to what's going on in our lives and particularly with young people growing up. I think that's important. That's why my daughter one comment she made to me was that she went over this. She said one of the things she was impressed about when she was growing up in our family was she knew that there were some things that I had trouble accepting in the church. The black issue was understood by her at a very young age because I struggled with it. And she said it was helpful, Dad, for me to know that. Now, I suspect there would be many who would not feel that was that maybe I should have kept up a solid front until maybe they were 40 or 50 before they found that sort of thing. but I'm too open a person to it. No.
Okay, let me try to repeat the question again. You're saying that you see the emphasis being follow your leaders and their spirituality, follow their example rather than work through your own. Well, I think you see with all three of us, and I'll just speak for myself here, the fact that all three of us have thought very seriously about our own spirituality and what that means. I think that I'm still... Even though I'm much more conscious of it now, I'm still very aware of what the spirituality of the leaders is or at what I perceive it to be. And then it seems like I still use that very much as a something that I bounce off of in my own spirituality. But, you know, mine changes so much, and it's such an evolving thing that I can't even put my hand on it right now. It's quite nebulous for me, and I feel, in a certain sense, I still feel very connected or obligated to what my spirituality is compared to a church leader's spirituality, but there's also another part of me that's kind of working through what my own is, and I can't tell you what that is, but I recognize that I'm still quite tied to this perception I have of what it's supposed to be, even as I try to decide what it is for me. Allie or Preston, do you want to talk about that?
For me to follow my leader spiritually has been a spiritual quest in and of itself, to actually come to knowing in myself that these leaders are here to help us, that they are, that they can receive inspiration, even beyond their means of judgment without it, and also understanding that they are fallible, and that when they do give us counsel, we still are responsible to find out for ourselves whether or not, we're not just supposed to go, okay, and we'll dive off the cliff. You know, we're supposed to find out for ourselves. And a big part of that for me to come to that point, and I'm still not on this totally peaceful plane of understanding it, is not being so quick to judgment when I hear something that I don't agree with, or not being so quick to judgment when something does sound good. I still got to keep certain things in check and then go with it eventually. But also, something that one of Tony's associates told me many times is some people would rather be right than happy. And when it comes to listening to counsel of our leaders, I think we really just need to take certain things with a grain of salt. We still don't relinquish, in my opinion, we don't relinquish our free agency by actually giving them the benefit of the doubt sometimes.
My experience with trying to become like your leaders, I took it more like these men and women are really close to God, have a good relationship, very in tune. And for me, it was just, you need to do that, but not necessarily become exactly like them, because the impression I got was, yes, and search for the truth until you know this church is true, not necessarily, you know, until you find truth. And, I mean, I guess it could be truth for some people in that church, but there wasn't a lot of flexibility in that idea for me. But for the leaders, I took it more as just become more in tune and more in touch with God or a higher power, whatever you want to call it.
Okay. That's a great question. The question is, all of us have stood up and said, oh, offer them free agency and give them wide rein and allow them to make their own choices. But being adults and having been through experiences and knowing more of the world, when do you need to step in and be an interventionist? Just from, again, from a pedagogical point of view, the parents who are the most successful parents are the parents who allow their children who define a framework for them so that the children know where the boundaries are. They know that there is a curfew. They know that certain behaviors are expected, but that those are flexible, that they can be negotiated perhaps. And the parents who are willing to enter into negotiation kind of relationships with their children, having set boundaries that are reasonable, find that they're more successful as parents. And I would say that's certainly true as a teacher. I find that I'm more successful as a teacher anyway when I make clear what the boundaries are, but I'm willing to negotiate on an individual basis. And I know that doesn't answer spiritual questions like you're talking about, but at least from a pedagogical point of view. Is there somebody else here?
No, you did it.
Okay. Yes.
It's a similar question. I noticed when Allie was talking to
myself. Okay. The question is, this woman is trying very hard to allow her children to make their choices and to give them free agency, and she's wondering how much is too much and what kinds of signs could she look for to see that maybe there's not enough of a safety net for her children to feel safe or secure.
Define your own value system and let your kids know what that is. And if you do that, then I think the kids will decide whether to go within that value system or to step out of it. But if you define your own, then the kids will follow your example. Yes, but it's age-based. You know, we get these kids when they're totally and completely dependent and they have to obey. They can't even, you know, handle their own potty training or things like that. And so we have to take care of everything for them. And then gradually we move on a smooth line, and we hope that it's smooth, until they get to be 18 or 19 or 32 years old or whatever age that happens to be. At that point, that they take a responsibility for their own life. You know, life's a balance anyway, you know, and it's you're always trying to keep at least one ball in the air. And I don't know how to do that.
Oh, this woman wants to, he said in his talk that he finally found the answer for himself. She wants to know how he came to terms with polygamy.
Okay. Well, I remember the common answer that I'd hear as a younger missionary was, oh, well, as they were crossing the plains, men died, and there were widows, and you know, helpless women with lots of children, and so they had. And then as I was reading on Joseph Smith and things like that, I came to understand that polygamy was reinstated, you know, way before the trek west. When it comes to a satisfactory answer, one thing that helped me was understanding that that was a practice in the past, in the Old Testament, and that the restored gospel is a return or a restoration of the fullness of the gospel, restoration of all things. However, you know, as mentioned by, Cindy, just like the deal with Paul mentioning women speaking in church and things like that. Does that mean that should be a restoration of the past? Of course not. When it comes to the issue of polygamy, I'm not totally at peace with it. However, as I look at it, I come to understand how difficult that must have been, not from just a female's perspective, because I can't very easily, but from a male's perspective. Whew. And, you know, it's not something that I'd want to get into. And so those that were into it most likely, you know, did it at great sacrifice. And so it's difficult for me to be a judge of that. All I know is there are some things that doesn't keep me up at night, in other words. Maybe I'm taking the easy way out.
Do you have a question, or was that just your comment? The comment's fine.
I'm a psychologist.
I'm curious what you would say. The question, or the comment was, is that he has a stepson who's 16 and thinking of going on a mission, and this man didn't know whether or not he should share his doubts and the problems and the sense of betrayal and so forth that he's felt. And rather than say anything, he didn't say anything at all. Do you think he should have said something?
Yeah. I think that particularly in dealing with adolescents, probably the most important thing that we can do is be honest. And I think that not saying anything is really not being honest. I think you need to discuss both the pros and the cons. Going on a mission is an extremely tough situation. Isn't it, Preston? You just got back. I mean, it's hard. Coming home is hard. And I think that we talk to these kids and we say, this is the best 2 years of your life, and we're lying to them. And we teach them to perpetuate this lie, and we tell them this is tough, you know, it's tough. It's 180 degrees below zero up there, and you have to go out and knock on doors, and you have to carry a golf ball because you can't hit it with your knuckle because your fingers will break off, you know. And you need to tell these kids some of those kinds of things, and I think that honesty is the policy that we need to use with our kids.
Let me just add one thing to that. I'm just thinking back about my own childhood. I was just an ardent believer from the time I was a small child. And my father was an inactive member of the church. And that created real pain for me in my household. And I remember several times him telling me what he thought about the church, which just devastated me. And I think back about that now, and I think that he should have been honest with me, but I think that he wasn't particularly respectful of where I was coming from. So while I think you should be honest and share with your child what your experience has been, I think you also need to be respectful of him as a person and where he's coming from too. And, you know, the same respect we'd give a Catholic person, a Jewish person, we ought to give our own people. Yes. Okay, the first question is, she wants to know the source of Tony's statistics on divorce. And then the second question is to Allie, what was the impetus that made you hit rock bottom?
Journal of Family Psychology, June 1993.
Okay, Journal of Family Psychology, June 1993.
For me, when I was 14, I was anorexic and bulimic. And when you get into patterns like that, it's very self-destructive, self-defeating. I really wanted to die. I wanted to die. I felt like I deserved to die. And luckily for me, my mom took me to a psychologist. I also got involved with a 12-step program. And in 12-step programs, they emphasize finding a higher power of your choice that will help you overcome this problem. And it was only through like 2 or 3 years of looking back on what caused my anorexia and bulimia that helped me to spiritually grow and to fit God in there somehow. But if I hadn't ever got involved in any kind of therapy, I probably would have just went on until I died. So, yes, you need to let your kids hit rock bottom, but I think you also need to maybe suggest someplace they can go to find answers, or self-esteem is really a big thing, but just maybe emphasize finding their own answers that can solve problems.
Okay, I think the comment or the question is, she had been taught a specific way of receiving answers, getting a burning in your bosom or whatever it was, and that became paralyzing to her sometimes because she didn't get that. And those have long-range implications. And you're asking, as far as the church goes, okay, so how could the church restructure or reemphasize, or how not to let your own child get caught in the syndrome?
Is that an effective model? Yeah.
No, not for me. Anyway, I think that one of the things I would say is that while that might be one way of getting answers, it may just be one way of getting answers, and that there are other effective means as well, and that we ought to explore or look at those means, and that we ought to use all of the social sciences and the history and the, you know, all of the disciplines that we have at our disposal to look at other effective means that can be used in conjunction and ought to be used. Somebody, Tony or Toby? Or?
A Sunday doesn't go by that I don't deal with it. and I think that for some it's never resolved. They expect that they've been led to believe, and their experience says they're going to get answers, and so they wait for them, and they wait. My best way I think of dealing with that is to let them know that it didn't happen for me in most of my major life's decisions. Let them know how I've wrestled with some of those questions, how I've come to answers on them. Doesn't mean it can't happen, and I believe it does, but I think by and large teach the principle the Lord sent us here to work out things on our own, basically, and he may help us sometime when we least expect it, but the responsibility is ours. Stress it's an individual responsibility, not you can't dump it on the Lord.
Yes. Okay, good comments. The first one was that she really doesn't even like the words rules and framework very much, but prefers communication as a way of raising her children and letting them learn to make their free agency. And secondly, that we talk a lot about how destructive divorce can be or how difficult it can be, but also that relationships that lead up to divorce are often equally or more difficult. Yes. Okay. He lives in Utah Valley and has a 13-year-old daughter and wonders how he's going to help her overcome some of those stereotypes. I think that there are a lot of things that you can do as a parent. First of all, be careful of the examples and the things that you say or do. You know, who do you hold up as role models, and what kinds of possibilities do you offer to your daughter as compared to your son? I think a lot of it may go back to what Tony says. What are your own values? And if she perceives from you that you see women, for example, as being able to do whatever they want, and emphasize women you admire who do things that are maybe go against the norm or the stereotypes that she's been learning, I think a lot of that can be overcome in the home. Any comments here? Allie, how would you respond to that?
Like she was saying, it's through your example that she'll know. My own father signed me up for soccer when I was in second grade. And I remember crying and crying because I didn't want to play a boy sport. And at the time, I couldn't understand why he was making me do that. But now I'm very thankful for that, and I've played soccer all through high school. And it made me realize that girls can do things just as well as boys, whereas maybe the traditional role, I'd be like, well, girls have to cook clean, you know, take dance, cross-stitch. And it just, I think it's through your own example. You may be doing things that you're not aware of, but it is. She'll know what you think she can or can't do, and she'll mirror that belief. So
we are out of time. Thank you very much. It's been an enjoyable session.